Ukraine is working to make its national grid operational after Russia's latest airstrikes leave several cities in the dark. Germany is expecting to see a growth in public deficit next year amid a severe energy crisis. And Peru's Congress rejects a bill to hold early elections as violent protests continue over the ouster of former President Pedro Castillo. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, a barrage of Russian strikes has battered Ukraine's grid, knocking out water and electricity services in several regions. The national energy provider has warned Ukrainians it could take longer to restore electricity. It has also imposed emergency blackouts, saying its system had lost more than half its capacity after strikes targeted backbone networks and generation facilities. Russia missiles targeted multiple cities, including the capital, Kiev. The chief commander of Ukraine's armed forces said 60 out of 76 Russian missiles were intercepted and destroyed, but they took a heavy toll on infrastructure and killed two people after a rocket hit a residential building. The Russian-controlled eastern Lugansk region also hit by Ukrainian shelling, leaving at least 11 people dead and many more wounded. Moscow and Kiev have stepped up attacks against each other's positions in recent weeks. The United States is finalizing plans to send its Patriot missile system to Ukraine. Kiev has long been asking its Western allies to provide it with the systems ever since the war with Russia broke out in February. Russia has already warned the United States and its NATO allies against supplying the Patriot systems to Kiev.
The United States is finalizing plans to send Patriot missile systems to Ukraine. The plan needs the final approval of U.S. Defense Chief Lloyd Austin and the U.S. President Joe Biden. It is not known how many of the batteries will be sent to Ukraine, but reports say supplies to Ukraine will be limited. But according to available data, a typical Patriot battery includes a radar set that detects and tracks targets, computers, and a power-generating equipment. It also includes an engagement control station and up to 8 launchers, each holding 4 radio-fire missiles. The systems are likely to be sent to the U.S. Army base in Grafenwöhr, Germany, where Ukrainian soldiers are likely to be trained and use the equipment. Ukraine has long been requesting the U.S. to send advanced long-range air defense system.
The message is simple. Give Patriots as soon as you can. Because this is the system that Ukraine needs to protect its civilian population and critical infrastructure. This is not an offensive weapon.
Russia has already warned that Patriot missile systems in Ukraine, if are deployed in the conflict, will be targeted. The former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev, who is now Deputy Chair of the National Security Council, had earlier warned that such weapons and their crews would be legitimate targets if a NATO member were to deliver them.
The U.S. has recently boosted its air defense support to Ukraine, citing a surge in Russian missile attacks. Washington has so far provided Ukraine with over $19 billion in military assistance since the beginning of the conflict. The Patriot is one of the most advanced U.S. air defense systems against aircraft and missiles, but its effectiveness has come under increasing question.
The U.S. and its Western partners have already resupplied Ukraine's air defense missiles and shoulder-fired Stinger missiles and other larger air defense systems. Patriot missile system is one of the most advanced U.S. systems against aircraft and missiles. Ukrainian officials say the delivery of Patriot missiles would be a game-changer, but the efficiency of those weapons for Ukraine in the war against Russia is not clear. Each missile battery would require dozens of well-trained air defenders to operate. Even with an accelerated training program, could be sometime in early 2023 before a system is operational in Ukraine. Experts believe the Patriot has a more powerful radar that is better at discriminating targets, but it has its own limitations. Its efficiency would depend on how the weapon was delivered. The success rate of the Patriot has been repeatedly questioned. In 2018, Saudi Arabia's success in using Patriots against missiles fired in the Yemen war were questioned when evidence of systems failing emerged. The Patriot does not reportedly perform so well against small drones. It is not known whether the system's radar could pick up the small, low-flying drones or whether there were other issues. The U.S. has now committed more than $19.3 billion in weapons and other equipment to Ukraine since the war began in February of this year.
As we work with industry to accelerate production on both replenishment systems and direct procurements under the United Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative, or USAI, we're using a number of tools to get the funding moving and the contracting happen quickly. These include using contracting mechanisms called things like undefinitized contracting actions, sometimes called UCAs. What that allows you to do deliberately is get industry working on an initial contract before we definitize it. And you can put a UCA together within a week, and we're doing that. We also are making use of indefinite delivery indefinite quantity contracts, or IDIQ. If you have IDIQs, and we have many of them, what you can do is just add task orders to them very quickly to get equipment on contract.
It is widely believed that those U.S.-made weapons are fanning the flames of war in Europe. But there are concerns that those weapons are falling into the wrong hands.
We're seeing this incredible, historic flow of weapons coming into Ukraine. Do we have any sense as to where they're going?
We don't know. There is really no information as to where they're going at all.
You know, all this stuff goes to the border, and then kind of like something happens, it kind of like 30% maybe reaches its final destination.
Washington is reportedly looking into technological solutions to the problem of weapons diversion. Western weapons earmarked for Ukraine had reportedly surfaced in the hands of militant groups in the African Sahel.
Turning elsewhere, thousands protest on the streets of Brussels demanding more support to deal with a growing cost of living crisis. Many of those who took part questioned how the EU can send billions of euros to Ukraine while neglecting the basic needs of citizens across the 27-country bloc. Jerome Hughes has more from the Belgian capital.
Protest through Brussels on Friday was organised by Belgium's three largest unions. They claim the country's federal government and EU authorities are failing to adequately help citizens during the current escalating cost of living crisis. Many also question how the EU is able to set aside at least 20 billion euro for Ukraine in 2023.
We are all against this war because it's about imperialism, it's about money. There's more behind. It's not only about Ukraine and about Russia.
Ukraine is a key point, but our people here as well. And the money is there. People have to be taxed properly, especially the 1%.
It's important to help the Ukrainians, but what about the people here in Europe and in Belgium?
The EU's energy sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine have backfired. Oil, gas, diesel, petrol and electricity prices are through the roof. Inflation across the eurozone is running at 10%. However, wages are not going up.
Many people can't buy the good food. Many people can't pay for our apartment.
Landlords are taking advantage from the inflation to raise the rents.
Landlords will now have another excuse. The European Central Bank increased interest rates by a half of 1% on Thursday.
And based on the substantial upward revision to the inflation outlook, we expect to raise them further.
The national strike on Friday resulted in flight cancellations, according to Brussels Airport. There were also major disruptions to tram, bus and metro services. Union members, not just here in Belgium, but across the EU, are warning of protests throughout 2023, which will impact public services, unless their cost of living concerns are addressed. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Meanwhile, Germany says its public deficit will grow to 3.25% next year as the energy crunch pushes the government to dip further down into its pockets. Finance Minister Christian Lindner to warn that if government spending goes up, that figure could even reach 4.5%. The government has unveiled a 200 billion euro plan to dampen the effect of soaring energy prices for the public. Part of the plan is to put a cap on gas prices for households and businesses. However, German economy is still expected to contract by 0.4% in 2023. The country expects its net borrowing to climb above 45 billion euros, nearly triple the initial estimates. Economic analyst Kirscher Campbell says the growth in Germany's public deficit has its roots in the country's over-reliance on Russia's gas and decisions by the central bank in Berlin.
When you think of certain dynamics or decisions or practices that were taking place in Germany, we realize that there could have been other decisions to mitigate this impact at this time. So, for example, when we think of Germany, it's a primarily industrial country. So you have the chemical sector, they're relying on natural gas. And we look further, we see that Germany was relying on Russia for most of that natural gas, most of that energy. So that, again, is a red flag. If, as a country, you are relying on a source for, let's say, 70 or 80% of a certain supply, that is a huge red flag. Because if negotiations go sour, if things go downwards, then you're in a problem. And this is one of the foundations that was shaky, and that has led to Germany being in this situation. Another thing which I will comment on is the impact and the role of the central bank. So think of like a parent and a child, right? You're, as a parent, you're responsible for your children. The central bank is responsible for certain policies in the country, interest rates, they manage inflation. So as the central bank, they are looking at various statistics, trends, making forecasts. So there are indicators that things are going downwards. We need to take action. We need to start having certain policies, certain remedies implemented quickly to mitigate, to lessen the impact overall of what is happening in the country and what it, where it's headed, right? So that is another thing I see, the role of the central bank and the choices, the decisions made, the policies that were adopted did impact, you know, the road to this situation for Germany.
Turning to Peru now, where the country's Congress has rejected a bill to hold early elections, which were aimed at ending the deadly protests over the ouster of President Pedro Castillo. The proposal was to move the elections from 2026 to December 2023. It fell short of the 87 required votes. Castillo's successor, Dina Boluarte, had called for the snap election to ease an ongoing unrest, which has so far killed 18. The Supreme Court has extended the pretrial detention of Castillo for another 18 months. The leftist ex-president was impeached and arrested after he announced plans to dissolve Congress and rule by decree. The Peruvian Defense Ministry declared a 30-day state of emergency after all-out protests and roadblocks following Castillo's arrest last week. The families of the victims of a stampede in the South Korean capital, which claimed 158 lives, have gathered to hold a candlelight vigil. 26 foreigners, including 5 Iranians, died in the tragedy. Information revealed in the aftermath of the stampede showed the police failed to respond to repeated emergency calls. Frank Smith reports from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
The family members of the victims of the Itaewon tragedy and thousands of their supporters remembered those 158 mostly young people whose lives were taken in a crowd crush October 29th. Some read letters to their lost loved ones.
Last year, we made a whole bunch of snow ducks all around outside our apartment. Please come and see me in my dreams sometimes. Please come see me someday. maybe even as my future child. I love you forever, Seon.
Although tens of thousands were gathered, police did not manage the crowds and ignored emergency calls hours before the deadly crush. Among those who perished in the tragedy, 26 of them were foreigners. 5 of those were Iranian. And like many of the young people who died that evening, they were students who visited South Korea to get more experience in the world and primarily more education to better themselves. Victims' families want the truth and those responsible brought to justice. A class action lawsuit is suing the government, which has often deflected responsibility and blamed the victims. It reminds some of the ferry sinking in 2014, in which more than 300 people died.
The law should be a law to punish wrong people, but the government is humiliating, insulting, and degrading the victims and the families of the deceased. In the end, I think this happened because the Sewol ferry accident was not properly resolved.
Tonight marked the 49th day since the tragedy, signifying the end of the mourning period, when the spirit of those dead to be reborn reaches Buddha and bliss. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Now, Malaysian rescue workers are combing through the site of a deadly landslide for a dozen campers missing after the Friday incident. Search and rescue operations resumed Saturday morning after they were halted overnight due to heavy rain. Local officials, however, have not held out much hope of finding the missing campers alive. That's because of a lack of oxygen and weight of the soil in the area. They're possibly trapped in. The landslide hit an unlicensed campsite in a popular hilly area near the capital, Kuala Lumpur. It happened when campers were sleeping in their tents. Around 2 dozen people, including 5 children, were killed. Following the incident, Malaysia ordered the closure of campsites considered as high risk. That brings an end to our World Bulletin. Thank you for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
According to recent reports, hate crimes against Muslim communities across Canada increased by 71% in 2021. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International said, in the early morning of December 12th, an intruder attempted to disrupt the morning prayers by attacking the imam at the Islamic Foundation of Torino. A person walked in with his shoes inside the prayer area while the imam was leading the prayer at the mosque located in the city's east end. The intruder jumped over the congregants to reach the imam and not only shouted obscenities at him but also pulled his beard several times. Two members of the congregation grabbed the assailant and held him until the police arrived. After preliminary investigation, the police took the assailant away but said no charges would be laid. He was allowed to drive away in his own car. While it is fortunate that nobody was hurt, the imam was clearly shaken. According to eyewitnesses, the imam was shivering after the attack. No charges have been laid and the attacker was not taken into custody, police media officer Shannon Eames told CBC News. Police do not consider it a hate-motivated crime, and the individual left the scene after it happened, Eames added. In a statement, the mosque said, "Our hearts are deeply troubled, and we know that many in our community are deeply concerned. We simply do not have enough information to assess what led to this incident." The statement went on, calling on police to keep all avenues of investigation open, including potential hate motivation. Some reports have suggested that the assailant is mentally disturbed. It has become common to declare any assailant who attacks Muslims or their places of worship as mentally deranged. If a Muslim is involved in such activity, he is not only immediately branded a terrorist, but the entire Muslim community is vilified. The recent attack on the Islamic Foundation is the latest in a string of attacks on mosques across Canada. In September 2020, 58-year-old Muhammad Aslam Zafis was stopped and killed outside a mosque in Rexdale. Zafis was a volunteer caretaker who was checking to ensure congregants wore a mask before entering the prayer facility. His assailant, Gullihirm Van Nutgem, 34, attacked Zafis and slit his throat with a knife. On January 29, 2017, six members of the Quebec City Mosque were murdered in cold blood and another 19 injured. The assailant, 28-year-old Alexander Bissonnette, entered the mosque while the Muslims were offering night prayers. He was armed with a semi-automatic assault rifle as well as a pistol. Mercifully, the children were playing downstairs in the basement, otherwise many of them, too, would have fallen victim to the terrorist anti-Muslim rage. An equally horrific attack occurred in London, Ontario on June 6, 2021. Three generations of Afzal family were crushed to death by Nathaniel Veltman, who drove his van over them repeatedly. While the latest attack on the Islamic Foundation of Torino mercifully did not result in any injuries, it would be wrong to assume that such attacks won't occur in the future. Unfortunately, it is open season on Muslims in Canada. Middle East Eye also had an eye on this issue, writing, "Canadian Muslim groups are raising concerns about a recent attack in which an imam was allegedly assaulted during a morning prayer service in Torino. The Islamic Foundation of Torino said recently that an intruder had entered the mosque and disrupted the dawn prayer by assaulting the imam before two brave congregants quickly held him back and called 911. In its statement, the mosque condemned the attack and called on the police to keep all avenues of investigation open. "Our hearts are deeply troubled and we know that many in our community are deeply concerned after an incident took place this morning," the official statement read. However, the center said there was not enough information to know what the motivation of the attack was. "We understand that this is a difficult and scary time for our community. We must stress, however, that we simply do not have enough information to assess what led to this incident, the Islamic Center said. Toronto police are investigating the matter and have yet to charge the individual. The police said on Twitter that it investigates all potential hate crimes fully and that if charges are laid, it will provide an update to the case. The Imam Yusuf Barat released a statement saying that he and many of his congregants remain traumatized, in fear, and very worried after the incident. He said, "I pray that no individual or community ever face what horrific incident the IFD congregation and myself have experienced this morning." The National Council of Canadian Muslims and Canada's Council of Imams, CCI, also expressed their concerns over the incident. The CCI's statement said, "The bravery of the congregants to prevent this ugly incident from escalating is truly remarkable, and CCI strongly encourages all congregants to continue their increased vigilance." Experts in Canada previously told MEE that Canada has witnessed decades of anti-Muslim rhetoric, both from politicians and in the media. Islamophobic and anti-Muslim attacks have also surged in recent years, the most high profile being the mass shooting at Quebec City Mosque in 2017, where a white Canadian man shot and killed six people. An August report from Statistics Canada found that hate crimes against Muslim communities across the country increased by 71% in 2021. The government study found that the number of recorded attacks against Muslims rose from 84 incidents in 2020 to 144 in 2021. The jump in attacks followed a decline from the previous year, as in 2019, there was a total of 182 reported incidents targeting Muslims. A recent study from October tracked networks peddling Islamophobia throughout Canada over the past 4 years. The 240-page report outlined an ecosystem composed of media outlets, Islamophobia influencers, white nationalist groups, fringe, right-wing pro-Israel groups, security experts, think tanks, and the donors who fund their campaigns. While several reports have outlined the Islamophobia industry in the U.S., this study is the one of the first to deeply look into Islamophobia networks in Canada.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. U.S. lawmakers have passed a record $858 billion annual military spending bill. The unprecedented package is $45 billion more than what President Joe Biden had requested. The bill has allocated billions in producing major weapon systems as well as military aid to Ukraine and Taiwan. In this edition of Spotlight, we'll discuss the reasons behind the rise in the U.S. military budget while Americans are embroiled in economic hardship and the consequences of Washington's continuing military support for Ukraine and Taiwan. Joining us on Spotlight, we have activist and commentator Don DeBar, joining us from Ossining, New York. And we also have anti-war activist from the Answer Coalition, Richard Becker, joining us from San Francisco.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. DeBar. The U.S. Senate, as we know, has passed next year's defense bill, authorizing a record $858 billion in annual military spending. Share with us your perspective on this record-breaking bill, also known as the NDAA.
Well, it's the largest budget of any kind in the history of the world. You can start with that. The U.S. Military budget is the largest single a component of the federal budget, and it's by four times, I think, three or four times factor larger than the next largest military budget, which is a budget that's carried on the backs of 1.8 billion people in China, as opposed to 350 million people or 340 million people in the United States. It supports a network, basically a global occupation army that occupies Europe, occupies parts of Asia, Japan particularly, and South Korea, so-called. It occupies a good part of Africa by proxy through AFRICOM and directly. Of course, it occupies the living hell out of the United States. It absorbs much of the effort also in research and development, technology, and other things. It is the not only the elephant in the room, but the elephant and the room and everyone else in it. And it is essentially this diversion of resources that could be feeding, clothing, providing shelter and medical care and education to people who are sorely in need of it around the world, even in the United States, instead is spent on a mission whose ultimate expression would be the extinction of humanity. So I don't know what else to say other than to just describe it in naked terms and let people draw their own conclusions. Other than in one word, I would say is criminal.
Richard Becker, what are your thoughts on the ever-rising military budget of the U.S.?
Well, it's a real obscenity. I think between the time of 9/11, the September 11th in 2001, and over the next 20 years, the best estimates are that at least $20 trillion was spent on war and militarism during that time. And I think that's probably a conservative estimate. But these funds, that these unthinkable, unimaginable funds, I think it's very hard for us to even begin to wrap our minds around what these kind of numbers mean. $858 billion, how does one calculate that? But it certainly does, its purpose is not to protect the people of the United States. There's nobody threatening the United States. I mean, there's no country that would be so wild and out of control that it would do that. It's to really support the empire, and it is an empire. It's a worldwide empire, and it's kept in power and in place by militarism, by the military. The U.S. is slipping in many ways as far as its being the dominant world power when it comes to economics and finance and diplomacy and so forth, but it still is by far the world's leading military power. It's not something to be proud of. And it's also not something that is accurately reported. The $858 billion, as far as I know, does not include the Central Intelligence Agency. Last year, the Congress gave Central Intelligence Agency and the other intelligence agencies $25 billion more than they asked for. So there was about $85 billion more than that. In the Department of Energy budget, Department of Energy is hidden away there, and not very completely hidden, but money for nuclear weapons, billions and billions of dollars more for nuclear weapons. And so, you know, a great deal of the budget, the overall budget of the United States, really more than half of the discretionary budget of the United States, goes to militarism. And at a time when there is great need and great suffering around the world and inside the United States, and the fundamental problems of lack of health care, adequate housing, adequate food and clean water, a clean environment, these problems could be addressed and overcome if those kind of funds were spent not on war, but on meeting the needs of the people of this country and the world.
Don DeBar, the bill also provides Ukraine with additional security assistance in its war with Russia, $800 million to be exact. It also includes a range of provisions to aid Taiwan amid tensions with China. On the issue of Ukraine, is the plan to stretch this war out for as long as possible?
I think that's really a tactical question that I don't know the answer to, because the strategic objective, they've been pretty clear about it, is to basically regime change in Russia and a dismantling of the Russian Federation. They are now openly talking about this at the State Department, and they are actively holding public fora in various places with groups that they hold out as repressed nationalities in the Russian Federation, you know, building basically quote-unquote liberation movements. They're doing or trying to do what was done to the Soviet Union in 1991. I believe some people in policymaking positions there have the illusion or the delusion that they're going to be able to recreate 1991 and have the Russian Federation collapse and be dismantled by making war. However, there are some steps that are being taken now that are intrinsically escalatory, that have a much sharper curve towards, you know, total war, basically, between Russia and the U.S. and its puppet states in Europe. And we're talking now about the delivery of Patriot missiles, warnings from Russia that if you have Patriot missile batteries targeting our aircraft, we're going to be taking them out. The U.S., of course, would have American soldiers and military personnel and civilian personnel, you know, operating those batteries. And so there will be American casualties as a direct result of direct retaliatory strikes by Russia. This goes nowhere but directly to World War III in full. And that seems to be happening pretty quickly at the moment.
Richard Becker, amid rising tensions with China, this bill has allocated billions in defense support for Taiwan, as well as the fast-tracked weapons procurement. Now, a think tank senior advisor says it would also create a regional contingency stockpile, which would allow the Pentagon to put weapons in Taiwan for use if a military conflict with China arises. Now, have the consequences of such measures been thought through, in your opinion?
I think they have been thought through by the policymakers, by the people who are carrying out this policy in Asia, in the Indo-Pac, as they call it, command. You know, it's not discussed a lot, but part of the strategy, and this was explained by the outgoing Admiral Philip Davidson, who was the head of the Indo-Pac command last year when he was leaving office. And he said, you know, the first island chain countries have to be prepared not only for war, but for redundancy. And that was a very interesting statement, I thought. In other words, and this first island chain means Japan, Okinawa, Taiwan, the Philippines, Borneo, and possibly other countries. But what he was saying, and I think this continues down till today, is that they have to be built up militarily so that even if a war occurs, and of course it's in anticipation of a war with China, that they'll get hit, they'll suffer casualties and destruction, But and that's fine with the from the U.S. policymakers' point of view. But what they have to do is they have to be able to be redundant, meaning that they have to have so much weaponry that they can continue fighting or continuing serving as the bases for the United States to continue the war against China until victory. So, and it's important to point this out because on the one hand, it shows there's no concern whatsoever for the people of those countries or the people of China. It's cold-blooded approach to war. And also that this kind of planning means that the United States is disregarding the Shanghai Communique, and they have been for quite some time now. Shanghai Communique was signed 50 years ago in 1972, recognizing that there was, and it said, on both sides of the strait, everyone recognizes that there is one China. Now the U.S. is treating Taiwan not as part of China, and it hasn't been, as I said, for a while. It is treating it as a completely independent country that is an ally and a military ally, most of all, most important of all, to the United States. Very, very dangerous.
Don DeBar, Washington is not shying away from cranking up tensions with China, but the repercussions of that, like with the situation similar in Ukraine, it could be devastating.
Yeah. You know, and the real scary thing is, there's a couple of things that are going on. In addition to what Richard just said, by the way, there's been an ongoing, drive practice to remilitarize Japan, both in terms of armament and also in terms of mission, because they're now talking about having Japan more or less patrol on behalf of the alliance, quote-unquote, certain areas where they'd be facing down China. With the history of that, that's a pretty frightening thought all by itself. But you have a situation in Washington where, let's say, looking at Ukraine, Bernie Sanders, or no, that was even Yemen, it wasn't even Ukraine. Bernie Sanders is talking about trying to, call up the war powers resolution on the Congress, and he can't do it even on Yemen. Instead, you have an 83-11 majority in the Senate for this, for the budget and for these policies where they're beefing up Taiwan for a war with China. So it's kind of hard to figure out where the political breaks would be on the march to the gallop towards war, almost on every front. You know, they're fighting in Africa in five or six different places, and even someone has tried to assassinate, I don't know his status at this point, at one of the Russian staff people in the Central African Republic. You've got, of course, Ukraine war, Yemen war, the chest thumping in Asia around both Korea and China with the United States and South Korea and Japan. And they're increasing the budget by, 5% more than they asked for, and the request was a record. I don't know how you find breaks inside the political system or inside even a legal construct to put on this thing that looks like it's going to be a global war. It's maturing in front of our eyes.
Sure. Richard Becker, let's turn our focus now to inside the United States. Doesn't the average U.S. citizen think that there are more pressing issues other than overseas military spending? The country continues to be hit by exceptionally high inflation, with almost every other major economic indicator also being mired in long-term problems.
Well, yes. You know, there's been a very intensive and extensive propaganda campaign inside the United States in support of the U.S.-NATO proxy war in Ukraine. And I think that this is something that, has affected the population because it's so incredibly one-sided. It's so one-sided that, we had a couple months ago the members of the Progressive Caucus in Congress sent a letter to President Biden And the letter said, oh, we salute you. And it wasn't even anti-war. It was like, we salute you for the war effort, the military aid to Ukraine and so forth. I mean, really kind of disgraceful for people who are supposed to be anti-war. But they said then, well, but, you know, maybe we could also have negotiations. And there was a huge response to that from not only the Biden administration, and not only by the Republicans, but by the leaders of the Democrats in Congress. And they retracted the letter in one day. And it, and I bring this up because it shows how intense the propaganda campaign for the Ukraine war. And the Ukraine war, you know, it's a terrible war. You know, and it's a war between peoples who just a little over three decades ago were part of the same country and who share a lot in the way of the history and culture and religion, language, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's very tragic that it's taking place. Having said that, it is clear that it was the U.S. and NATO, and particularly the U.S., that refused any negotiations ahead of time that could have staved off this crisis. It could have avoided this crisis and this war. And that's where the primary responsibility lies. They've surrounded Russia to a large degree, or European Russia, with their military allies, and they were trying to complete it by bringing in Ukraine, which would have been the most devastating to Russia's national security. They have NATO in Ukraine, and NATO and NATO weaponry in Ukraine. So, you know, there's been all the propaganda, and it's, you know, washed over people, but we in the anti-war movement here, we're planning activities next month around the time of the Martin Luther King Day commemorations, remembering King's opposition to the war in Vietnam and to wars around the world, and highlighting that. And, you know, we have to reach out to the population and try to counter that propaganda to the greatest extent possible.
Donabar, putting into question the timing of this bill, the U.S. national debt, if I'm correct now, stands at around $31 trillion. Does this show basically how threatened Washington could be by the major economic powers which are emerging, and with it, an emerging multipolar world?
Well, the first thing it shows is the priorities of the people who make the budget. People in the United States are more housing distressed, healthcare distressed, food distressed, just about everything, infrastructure distressed, as they've been in decades. And it's deteriorating on the back of inflation that's eating away at whatever money people have aside or in their pocket, and also just in terms of the dismantling of entire economic nodes, you know, supply lines and all of this. And that is becoming institutionalized. In other words, it's just a continuing degrading of the condition of people in the United States. And it also shows that they do, of course, take note of the rising multipolarity in the world. And they are, rather than sitting back and trying to engage it and saying, okay, well, we could be first among peers or something along those lines and satisfy themselves with being sort of president of a college of the rulers of the world, they're going for the gusto and they're willing to blow up the world. They're showing us that they're willing to go to the brink in order to accomplish that, and they're spending the money on the weapons that can do it, and they're starting to use them.
Richard Becker, U.S. senators backed the bill by an overwhelming 83-11 bipartisan majority. There's a lot of talk about the great divide in U.S. politics, but politicians, they can still produce bipartisan consensus when it's needed. And there's always consensus on wars and military spending in America. Am I right?
There's always consensus on the war. I mean, it's only in the most extreme conditions where the war has been lost, like in the last years of the Vietnam War, that there's real opposition and even rejection at some points of military budgets. But other than that, year in, year out, you know, we hear how, you know, difficult it is to get anything good for the people through the Congress, how we, you know, but then when the military budget time comes around, it's like it just almost automatic that it goes through. And the corporate mass media in the United States is very linked to the also to the military industrial corporations. and the banks, and they're all linked together and with the oil companies, and they benefit from this. They benefit from war. They are the beneficiaries of this military policy, and everybody else constitute the losers when it comes to militarism.
And same question to you, Mr. DeBar. Disagreements on issues like guns, abortion, health care, but it seems like the partisan bickering and infighting, the line is drawn when it comes to the issue of militarism.
You know, you can have disagreements about all of those issues, and before you decide who's right and who's wrong, find that all of the people who are arguing end up as radioactive wisps of steam. And then how significant are these other issues in the face of that? And that is where we're at.
All right. I guess we're going to wrap it up. Any final thoughts from you, Mr. DeBar?
Yeah. Just in general, the resources that are being expended right now could be used to house and clothe and feed half the population of the world that's in severe distress over those things, including the 9 or 10 or 12 million people that will die of starvation this year alone. These are products of U.S. foreign policy and of the U.S. budget process that could be resolved with one person in the White House with executive power exercising that, or a Congress that has some human beings in it instead of a bunch of vampires.
Richard Becker, would you like to add anything to that final comment?
No, I'd like to concur with that comment, and I'd also like to say that I think if people want to see where all the money is going, Google U.S. Military commands worldwide or something like that, and see this incredible situation that has never existed before in human history, where the whole world is encompassed in the military commands of one country. I mean, it's amazing. And it's disgraceful, and it's really holds the possibility for the destruction of humanity.
All right, on that note, we're going to wrap up tonight's Spotlight. Thanks to activist and commentator Don DeBar, joining us from Austin, New York, and Richard Becker, anti-war activist from the Answer Coalition, joining us from San Francisco, and a special thanks for staying with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means...
Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from...
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decree. His decree, though, we learn...
This is Foresight, a program on how to worship Allah. So, dear listeners, we are talking about the presence of heart and the negligence of the heart, and how both of these are related to our ubudiyya, our servitude, our worship, and our obedience to Allah, and of course how we can improve our ubudiyya with the knowledge of these two. So when we look at the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt and the Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, we find that the presence of heart is one of the things that is highly, highly stated when it comes to the salah. Now, as many of you very well know, the more the presence of heart that an individual has in their salat, and their salat, of course, is the five daily wajib obligatory prayers that must be done by a Muslim, the more the presence of heart one has in this wajib salat, and for that matter, in the mustahab salat as well, the more the presence of a heart, the more powerful the effects of this salat becomes. And along with that, the more value is given to that salat. And of course, in turn, this presence of heart and this focus and this paying attention to the Almighty Allah in this very formal worship and this formal ubudiyya is something that really powers up and increases and strengthens our overall ubudiyya. So when we're also talking about the presence of heart, as we said, the more the presence of heart that is there, the higher is the probability of the acceptance of that prayer. Now, of course, we should never be arrogant and proud and haughty in the sense where we expect Allah the Almighty to accept our prayers. Of course, this is pride and arrogance, and then this leads to other diseases, which will, of course, lead to our downfall. But if we look very beautifully at this concept that we have just brought up, if we are humble and we hope and we pray that Allah will accept our prayers, and of course, at the same time, we realize that our prayers, they are faulty when it comes to that which the Almighty Allah deserves, then the probability of the acceptance of our prayers goes up.
IRIB English Radio. Our website, www.parstoday.com.